Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Mac, and you are listening to Mac's Musings. Of course, on the West Coast, it is the afternoon, and that is where my guest is. She's on the West Coast, and I'm going to be calling her. I just need to put her number in, and this is going to be a real treat for anybody that is listening, because my guest is none other than Judy Norton. And yes, it is that Judy Norton. So stand by, and hopefully we should be talking to her soon. Ringing.
Hello. I'm just putting in my earpiece.
Okay. So can you hear me okay, Judy?
There we go. Okay, yes.
Okay, good.
Are we good?
Because as long as we can hear each other, that means we're on the air. So
perfect.
How are you tonight?
I'm okay.
Good,
how
good.
Are you?
Glad
you're ahead of me. I'm still looking at sunshine.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's pretty dark here right now. Well, not really, because I have my lights on. But, I mean, if your lights aren't on, it's dark. So,
yes.
The first thing I wanted to ask you is probably pretty standard. When did you know that you wanted to be going into the film business?
Wow. I don't remember it ever being a specific, decision point. I had started, my parents got me started in, dance, ballet classes, things like that. I did little musical recitals as a kid. So all of that pretty much happened when I was very young, and I always thought it was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it, and I always loved being on stage and performing. So it just was sort of a natural progression, and it was more that I never hit a point where I went, I don't like this, I don't want to do this.
Well, that's good that you didn't dislike it.
Yeah, I mean, there have been moments, later in life where I've gone, oh, what am I thinking? This is like the most impossible career to pursue. Why would anybody do this? And then I go, oh, because I love it, and I'd rather do this than anything else. So, okay, all right, carry on, deal with it.
Well, good. That's a nice way to think about everything. Now, one interesting thing I saw is that in 1986, you participated in 2 world records in skydiving. That sounds exciting. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I started skydiving because I was asked to do a stunt for Circus of the Stars. And it involved wing walking and skydiving. Yeah, I mean, it was predominantly supposed to be kind of a wing walking stunt where, I was pretty much, I climb, you do it in a biplane, so the passenger's in the front seat and you kind of climb up and there's a bracket, a brace sort of on the upper wing, and so you sort of strap into that, and then the pilot flies aerobatics. And then what was supposed to happen was, at one point when the plane was inverted, I was supposed to, oh my goodness, fall off, to the alarm of, the announcers. Oh my goodness, she's fallen off. What will we do? And of course, I'm wearing a parachute and open the parachute and land safely. So all of my skydiving training was really so that I could safely land. It wasn't about any actual in-air, work that I was going to do, but getting to a point where you are proficient and safe to do that, you go through the training. So I did, and I spent about a month training, and then we went to Las Vegas to film the stunt, and we had really high winds, and that's not safe conditions to jump in. So we shot all of the wing walking stuff, and then they said, well, we'll do the actual sort of skydive landing, that section when we get back to LA. So they scheduled a day, and the day they scheduled it for, there was clouds and rain, which are also not conditions that you jump in. So they ran out of time and they said, okay, well, we will tease the segment this year and then we'll finish the stunt next year. And then the following year. So I, by that time, after I'd done about, 30 jumps by that point in the first, month of training, I was kind of hooked. I'd gotten past being scared and past getting hurt and all of that. And I was just having fun. So I went, well, I need to keep jumping because we're going to do this next year and I'm having fun. So I kept jumping. And then the following year, they decided for some reason not to do that stunt, but they had a commitment to me. So they decided to give me an option between flying trapeze and high wire. I'm like, can't I just like put eggs on the noses of dogs or something, we never did the actual skydive stunt, and I learned flying trapeze instead. But I kept jumping for quite a few years, and during the course of that time, I had an opportunity to participate in a couple of world records that ended up being set. One was women, all women. We had 60 women, and the other one was combined men and women, and we had 120. So those were the two records. They've both since been broken, but there you go.
Wow. Yeah, but that's exciting. Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. It's pretty nerve-wracking.
Yeah, well, it sounds like it.
It's real. There's a lot of stress to it because it's very, it's kind of cutthroat. I understand it. Like if people, it's hard to do. So particularly with the joint combined men and women, you deal with all kinds of personalities and egos and all that kind of stuff. And I wasn't anywhere near as experienced as a lot of people on the jump who had thousands and thousands of jumps. But I was really good. So, and women are lighter and we have advantages because of that, because big, heavy guys just sink. So it's a little trickier
right.
for them than they don't always maneuver as easily. The kind of training and experience I'd had had geared me for being able to do the aspects that were necessary for this particular type of jump. But the thing is with that, nobody's ever done it before. So they're like, oh, can you, guarantee you can do it? I'm like, nobody can guarantee they can do this and won't make a mistake because nobody's ever done it before,
right.
But if people made mistakes, then, I don't remember how many attempts it took us, 12, 13, 14 or something. We worked on it over the course of several days. When it falls apart and doesn't happen, then, there have been people videoing, so then they go in and they study all the videos, and it's like, well, who screwed up, and heads are going to roll, and what do we need to do to make sure this is going to happen? And so you know that if anything goes wrong in there, there was a time where there was something that happened with where I was, and, so I was like, oh, my head's on the chopping block, and it ended up not being entirely my fault, so I ended up, getting a reprieve, and so it's like, oh, please let me not get kicked off. How humiliating, that moment, was like the biggest potential humiliation in my life was if I got kicked off, I'll never live it down. But I didn't get kicked off. We got the record and, but the pressure is pretty intense.
Well, I can imagine, especially with something that's that difficult to do and being new at it like you were when you first started, that had to be nerve-wracking. I can understand it.
Yeah. It was, There were times I remember when I was doing the training. So the training initially was about 8 hours. Because it was right around the time they were transitioning from all the training had in the past had been static lines, like the military trains where, you get it automatically opens. You're on a line that's attached to your parachute container, and when you go out the plane, when the line comes to the end, it opens your parachute pack, and that's it. Your parachute's open, so you don't really get to experience free fall because it only takes a couple seconds for that parachute to open when you go out the door. So they were starting to transition. So with that, you don't really get a chance to really learn how to get stable in the air right away. It's a gradual thing. I mean, I never trained that way, so I don't know all the steps. But with the way I was trained, it was a new method called accelerated free fall, AFF. And basically, you do a ton of ground training first, and then after that you go up with two instructors, and as you leave the plane, each one has a hold of you from the side. So they take you, they have a hold of you, you leave the plane together, they help you stabilize in the air, and then they gradually, over the course of several levels of training, they start letting go of you and teaching you what your position is and how to stay stable, and then how to move and all that kind of stuff until one of them stays with you until your parachute basically opens and pulls you out of their hand. So they're there in case you go, oh my goodness, where's my parachute? I can't find it. I can't find the handle. In which case one of the, that person would reach in and, pull the ripcord for you to make sure you had an open parachute. So I went through that kind of training. So the 8 hours, covers all of what can go wrong. So it's pretty funny because, like, I got the call and I was just doing a show. I was down in Texas doing a production of Annie Get Your Gun. So I'm there, we're almost wrapped up. I'm going, oh goodness, what am I going to do when this is over? And I get a call from my agent who says, well, I've just had a call from Circus of the Stars and somebody has dropped out of a stunt. And so they're putting out calls for this stunt. And the first person who says yes, is in. So, she's like, wing walking, skydiving. And I'm like, okay, say yes. And then I'll think about it, So I'm going, okay, yeah. And my concern was, I didn't know anything about wing walking or skydiving, and I thought all I knew was that I had sprained ankles several times, like playing tennis and different things, And I went, I don't have the strongest ankles, and, I could like sprain an ankle, break an ankle or something like that, I'm pretty athletic, but, because of that, I'd had these little odds and ends of injuries. So I'm going through this ground training, and they get to all these, these emergency procedures. Like, okay, well, if your parachute doesn't open, do this. If you have a line that does this, if this happens, do this. And I'm sitting there thinking, this is like halfway, like 4, 5, maybe 6 hours into the training, and I went, break an ankle? I could die doing this. What was I thinking? It was like that had never crossed my mind until that moment. I just thought, oh, maybe a broken ankle. It's like, oh shoot, man, this is like serious stuff. I could get real, So then I was like really nervous. I kind of went, okay, well, I'll keep going. It's like, if I'm freak out in the plane, it's not like they're going to push me out. So a lot of things went through my mind.
Oh, well, thanks for sharing all that.
Now, you'll edit that down to 3 minutes. She jumped from the plane.
Well, if you had something else to say, I mean, by all means, go ahead. I'm not trying to cut you off.
No problem.
Hey, okay. Because a lot of people may not know, I mean, I know, but a lot of people may not know that you are an accomplished singer. And you even performed on the Waltons. You did Hush Little Baby in one of the episodes. And you have CDs. One of the things that I wanted to mention, because it means something to me personally, well, and to my family, you were on an episode in 2015 of Home and Family. And for those listening, it's a daytime family talk variety type of show. And you performed a song from your CD, Reflections, at the end of the show, while pictures from the show of actors who had died, they were being displayed while you were singing. And it was just so beautifully put together and so beautifully done. And when I had taped it, and when my brother-in-law was watching it, he has never come to tears over singing. And he did when he was listening to you sing this song.
Yeah,
there you go. And I had never seen him cry during a song before, and he did. And well, I understand it because I was crying as well. But I did want you to talk about that, because that was just so beautifully done. Like, did you pick the pictures, or did you have anything to do with that, or did you just have to do with the singing part?
I did not pick the pictures. Hallmark must have pulled all that together. I specifically, when they asked me if I would sing, we had done a kind of a Walton reunion for, I think, like the 40th anniversary or something like that, of the Waltons, or the homecoming or something. I think it was probably of the Waltons starting. And the gentleman who emceed the evening works with Home and Family. And I sang at that event. And so he had heard me sing. So when they were putting this Walton gathering together, he said, I'd love if you would sing. And I said, well, yes, of course, I would love to. And he specifically requested that song, Times of Your Life. I'd sung along, to a recording of, with the radio or whatever, but I had never learned the song to sing it myself. So I went, okay, all right, fine. I didn't have any particular attachment to the song, but I went, okay, all right, fine. But it ended up being such a perfect choice because of, as you said, the slideshow that they ran, and then having, the cast that was there. And, it was very, emotional for me too. I was like, oh my goodness. And, and they were like, so sweet, in their reactions to it also. It ended up kind of being a very sweet moment. So I'm glad we did it.
Oh, yeah. Well, I did notice the reactions of everybody when they were listening to you. You could tell that they were just all thinking the same thing everybody else was. That you just have, and I'm not just saying this because you're on my show, but you really do have one of the most beautiful voices that I've ever heard.
Oh, wow. Thank you.
And I think it would behoove people to listen to your CDs, or to go and see you when you do live performances. And how often do you do that, by the way, do live performances?
Well, these days, not at all.
I guess I should put that another way.
Yeah.
Before COVID, how often would you?
Yeah, it really varied. I started... I actually, this is another, like, not 3-minute answer, but my mom sang professionally when I was growing up. And so I kind of got familiar with a lot of, she sang, all the sort of Great American Songbook, all the standards, The Doors, Day, Rosemary, Clooney, Frank Sinatra, all that stuff. So I grew up hearing a lot of that. Plus, she had scores from Broadway shows, which she would play and I would listen to and get familiar with. And so I loved all that music. And I had done little musicals, as I said, as a child, when I was, maybe six, seven, I auditioned for a children's production of Cinderella. And of course, because I thought I was so brilliant, I assumed that, they would cast me as Cinderella, which they did not. I was a Countess of the Ball, which made no sense to me because I don't ever remember there being a character that was a Countess at the Ball. But anyway, there you go. It was an invented character, and as was the music. They didn't use the Rodgers and Hammerstein music. They used, random things like Long Ago and Far Away, or, you know, things like True Love. So they kind of put together their own version. So I did that show for a year on the weekends. And, you know, I continued to sing around the house, all that kind of stuff. Well, when I was 16, I recorded myself one day. And when I played it back, I was horrified because my pitch was pretty non-existent. And I was like, you know, what I heard in my head sounded great. But when I played it back, it was bad enough that even with my ears not being great, I could hear it was bad. And I was so devastated because I so loved to sing, and I went, and I'm terrible, you know. So aww. I took myself off to a voice teacher, and I started taking lessons when I was 16. I always laugh when people go, why didn't you sing on the Waltons, you know? And it was like, well, that's very kind of you, but because I couldn't sing, really. That was when I was learning. So I spent a lot of years studying and really loved musical theater, so I really kind of focused on that. But I honestly never thought anybody would hire me to do it. I just didn't think I was good enough, and I was so self-conscious because I knew my ears weren't great. And so I was always, you know, I never wanted to sing around anybody because I thought if somebody even looked at me, I went, oh, I must be out of tune and I can't hear it. So I would only sing when I was by myself. And then when, so I, you know, I felt like I was getting better and whatnot, but I was still really, you know, kind of, you know, paranoid to sing around other people. And when I was, just after the Waltons, I had an opportunity to audition for Pittsburgh Civic Light Opera. And I got hired to play Cinderella.
Wow.
I was cool. Like, well, there's full circle. So then I got really excited because I thought, oh my goodness, somebody actually would hire me to do this professionally. So I'd been studying on and off. So then I got even more serious about it and spent a lot more years studying and, you know, expanding my repertoire, blah, blah, blah. So I really am a product of thousands and thousands of hours of hard work and practice and developing my ear and developing everything that it took. I was not a natural performer. Like, I watch these kids on these, you know, these shows, and I'm like, oh, yeah, right. You know, that was not me. So I'm always so flattered when, you know, when someone actually, you know, I still kind of, it's like the, you know, the person who's been chubby all their life, who never believes that they're thin. I'm kind of like that with my voice at times still. Like, I'm kind of a mixed bag. Sometimes I still don't quite trust that. I'm like, yeah, I'm okay. You know, so for years, all I would do was musical theater because I thought I could hide behind that. I'm an actor who sings, you know, it's like, as long as I'm doing a character, I can kind of go, if somebody says anything about my voice, I can go, well, I'm an actor, you know? And then mm-hmm. I finally hit a point with all the theater that I did where I had some opportunities to just do some straight concert stuff. And, you know, and it went well. And I went, so I finally hit a point where I was willing to say, I'm a singer, you know, and it just took a long time to get there. So I'm saying some of this because I know people go through things, you know, and it's really easy to look at people that you see who are successful and go, oh, well, that came naturally. That came easy to them. So I am testament to, if you really, really want to do something and you work hard enough, you know, you can get there. So, you know,
yeah.
That's my success story.
Well, yeah, and that's the way actually everything is. Some people have to work harder at some things than others. That's just the way it is. Just like when you were in school, some people were whizzes at math like me, and I'm not bragging, I'm just saying. Some people are whizzes at math and some people aren't, and some people are whizzes at doing history and some people aren't. You know, that kind of thing. And it works the same thing with singers and actors. And some people have to work at it. And some, it seems to come naturally, even though it probably doesn't. You know, like with you, it seems like that all just comes naturally. And that's what's nice about you coming on the show and talking about it, is because now we know that it didn't actually come naturally per se. You had to work at it to make it sound mm-hmm. like it does now, which is actually wonderful the way it sounds.
Yeah, well, It's true. Overnight success is never overnight.
No. It may seem that way, but it never is. Even when somebody, like, say they make a movie and it's their first movie that they know of, that people know of, and then the next day they're, everybody knows who they are because they were in this movie. Well, they did other stuff. They did theater, or they were doing whatever it is that they do. They were doing that. They didn't just, like, make the movie and then that's that. They did something before that that got them ready for mm-hmm. that. It's never overnight, like you say.
Right. Yeah.
So I do want to start talking about your films. Oh, I'm sorry, because sometimes there's an overlap and I don't realize the person is still talking. Were you going to say something else?
Nope. I was just agreeing with you.
Oh, okay. Now, at least this is what's in IMDb. That's what I'm going by. They have your first, it was actually uncredited for a hotel, but that was your first actress job, at least according to them. And you were like something like 9 years old. And so tell us about that, if you remember.
I do. I had done some, up until before then, I'd done just like some background work in some little commercials and films. Hotel, was probably the first, although I didn't have dialogue. That was an interesting audition because it wasn't, there was no dialogue. It wasn't like most auditions where you go in and you audition with them, with the scene or scenes. So in this case, it was just, they were looking for a little girl that, you know, I mean, there wasn't much description. So I had my little dress on and I went to the audition, and they called all of us into a room and had us kind of stand in a little semicircle. And I guess the director and I don't know who else was there, the casting director probably. And, you know, there were two or three people, it seemed like. And we kind of all stood there. Well, most of the other little girls knew some of the other little girls. So they were all kind of chatting and, you know, whatnot. And I was kind of standing kind of by myself, looking very uncomfortable and, you know, self-conscious, and because I didn't know anybody and didn't anybody to talk to. And anyway, I ended up getting cast. Now, I don't know whether that was because I, you know, wasn't animated and I was kind of looking a little, you know, scared and self-conscious. But anyway, I got hired. So that was very cool. And it was a pivotal scene in the movie because there's, it's an old movie, so hopefully not too many spoilers here. But, you know, it's this hotel that's being sold, and there's this elevator that they have trouble with all the time. And right towards the end, a number of the key characters from the show are all in this elevator together, has a problem, and it's in danger of crashing. And so we all have to be rescued from this elevator. So, you know, it was really just kind of this thing where, you know, there's one scene where you see me with my mother and we're standing in the hall waiting for the elevator, and then the elevator opens and we get in. And then there's the whole sequence in the elevator when, you know, it drops, you know, however many feet. And that was so fun because they had this fake, you know, they had this elevator rigged, you know, where to like drop like 2 feet or something, so that we all kind of, you know, could react and, you know, and fall to the floor and stuff. And I mean, we spent several days shooting this thing, you know, and then we had to be rescued, and, you know, and I got rescued from the elevator. And, you know, probably because it was, you know, one of my first jobs, and because I got to spend several days there and work with actors that I wasn't familiar with, but were pretty big stars. You know, I remember walking across the set one of the first days and my mom going, "Oh, there's Merle Oberon." And I'm thinking, who's Merle Oberon? You know, I had no clue, but my mom sure did, you know. And Carl Malden and Rod Taylor rescued me, and, you know, all of us from the elevator. And Michael Rennie, who, you know, was this classic actor, and he was so sweet. He sat around and played Old Maid with me.
Aww.
You know, I mean, as a kid, I had no clue that, you know, that wasn't something that, you know, a grown up distinguished gentleman actor would do, sit around with a kid and play old maid, you know. So I just had the best time, you know.
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah, you've done lots and lots of guest starring roles, and I'm not really going to pick over any of those. I'm just going to mention it because you did lots and lots of them, because we got lots of things that we can go over here. And we do have to talk about the obvious, of course. Now, it started in 1971 with The Homecoming, A Christmas Story, the TV movie. That, of course, turned into The Waltons, the TV series from 1972 to 1981. And then there were 7 TV movies, which included a documentary. Excuse me. And those were from 1980 to 1997. So tell us about that whole experience. You don't have to, like, go to 3 minutes. You can talk about it as long as you want. So tell us about working on the Waltons.
Ah, wow. Well, originally going into audition for The Homecoming we were auditioning just for this Christmas TV movie because that's all it initially was. So I went in and I knew that she was like, we read the scene in the barn when they're cracking walnuts. And, you know, Mary Ellen, my character, has quite a lot to say in there and is going off on a rant about how small Walton's Mountain is and it's this big universe. And, you know, I'm kind of just on a rant. So it was really good for me because it really gave me something to do that fell into kind of my wheelhouse. I didn't necessarily think in terms of 30s, which is what the time period was, you know, early 1930s during the Depression. You know, I wore cut-off jeans, you know, cut-off shorts and a T-shirt and had my hair in pigtails. But, you know, I had attitude. And evidently when I came in, Earl Hamner, just from, you know, kind of the way I was sort of embodying the character, he kind of went, that's her. Which I thought was lovely to hear years later. So what they did, which was very unusual, was they brought in six or seven actors. I don't remember if they had someone read the role of John Boy because that was already cast or whether the casting director or somebody read it. But they had, you know, 6 actors that they were auditioning and had each one of us, you know, read the different roles. So we did the scene together as a group of actors. And then they called us back another time and same sort of thing happened. I went in with 6, you know, 5 or 6 other actors and read the scene again. And then they called us back a third time. And this time there was only 6 of us there. And they brought us into the room and I think they maybe wanted to see us all together as, you know, did we make sense as a family? And they basically said, you know, you are the actors we'd like to hire, you know, it's like, you guys get the job, kind of, which never happened either. You never found out in the room. You know, you might have a sense of it that you did well and you kind of, you know, I've had those where I'm like, oh, I really think I nailed that. I think I'm going to get that. Sometimes I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. A lot of times I'm right, you know. But anyway, in this case, it's like, you know, you kind of went out and said, you know, they hired, you know, and then they called our agents and confirmed blah, blah, blah. So that was kind of that. And it was a 5-week shoot. And I'd actually just been hired for another film as well, and they conflicted. You know, it's kind of like, it's not like I did all that much work, so it's like, why do I have to now have 2 conflicting roles? And they both had things that appealed to me. I had a really good role in the other film. They both were going to go on location, which was exciting to me because I'd never been out of California. I'd never been on an airplane. I'd never, so, you know, the idea of going on location was like exciting to me. And there was something about the other role that I think at 13 appealed to me. I don't even remember what it was, but my agent said it was an independent film. And, you know, she knew enough about the industry to recognize that an independent film may or may not actually get made, sad to say. So she said, look, this other one, this is a CBS TV movie, you know, and this is where you should go, you know. And so I was like, okay, you know. And I remember, I think they wanted to, like, cut my hair, like, kind of like stick a bowl on my head type, you know, haircut. And I don't know that it was my agent or my parents or collectively that went, no. And I was like, thank goodness, you know. They did end up dyeing my hair red because we were all supposed to be redheads, but, you know. So we spent 4 weeks filming at CBS in Studio City, California, and we did all of the interiors. And then we went to Jackson Hole, Wyoming for a week and filmed all of the outdoor sequences in the snow. And they, you know, chartered a plane for a lot of the cast and crew. I don't know if it was everybody or not, but, you know, that we had this, like, you know, chartered, like, sort of DC-3. And we flew up there all together, and, you know, it was just magic for me. You know, it's like, oh, wow, you know. I loved it. I mean, we were freezing, you know. I was so ill-equipped for actual snow weather. But I remember I got, you know, snow boots, and I got, you know, a new coat, and, you know. It was pretty cool. So that's
something new for you.
Yeah. So we had such, and by that time, and we had also bonded because we'd spent 4 weeks filming together already, you know, and by the end of it, 5 weeks together. So we were, you know, and it was like every day. So I was, you know, out of school for 5 weeks filming. And then during that last week when we were in Wyoming, we started hearing some rumors that the producers wanted to turn it into a series. And, you know, I knew what that meant, but I didn't really understand what it meant. And I was kind of like, oh, I don't know if I want to do a series. I'll be out of school a lot. What about my friends? And you know, a 13-year-old thinking. But anyway, by the time it came around, and so they started talking. And I also didn't have any idea that just because the producers were thinking about that, that how difficult that is to make happen. You know, it was not a nothing to get from, wow, we have a TV movie too, we're going to turn it into a series. So I didn't know any of that. But by January, they had put us all on hold. And then we started filming in, I think it was June, because it was right after I graduated from junior high. And then it was just kind of year to year. We would spend 9 months out of the year filming. And it was incredible, you know. It was just the best, you know. I mean, I loved the work. I loved the cast. We are like a real family. So it's, you know, we didn't know that was strange. You know, I didn't have a lot else to compare it to, so I didn't know that casts don't always get along, that, you know, the kids, we went to lunch together every day. We were, you know, we all really liked each other. I mean, we still do. We still all talk to each other. We still get together. We still, you know, share personal moments in our lives, you know, weddings and births of children and bar mitzvahs and, you know, I mean, all kinds of stuff. And we go on vacations together and, you know, I mean, it's just family. So, you know, and it started right there from the homecoming because all of the kids were the same. And then they changed out a number of the parents, the adults and whatnot, when we did the series, but we quickly bonded with them. And it was just a joy. I mean, not every day was fun. You know, there were days when it's like, oh, I don't want to be here. And why do I have to do this again? And why am I doing the same thing every day? And, you know, or, you know, your personal things were going on in your life. And it was the 70s, so we didn't have cell phones. And you couldn't do everything over the internet. So it was like, I can't even make a dentist appointment. I can't even go to the bank because I don't know when I have a day off. And, you know, so, I mean, it was typical. I came to learn that the things that, you know, regarding actors, I said the two things you can say about actors is they complain when they're working and they complain when they're not working. You know, it's just, I don't know, somewhere in our DNA. But I did learn, I mean, I feel all along the way, I basically also took the time to appreciate it and recognize how lucky I was. And we were pretty isolated from, we didn't have direct contact with the audience very much at the time. We'd go out and do a parade here or there or some other publicity thing, but I didn't have a lot of direct interaction with the audience until further into the show. I mean, we got a lot of fan mail, but it really wasn't until more towards, and when I went to school, kids made fun of me because the Waltons wasn't cool in L.A. in the 70s, you know. So being in L.A., nobody made a big deal. It's like, oh, the Waltons, oh, that's, you know, sort of sappy little show. And so none of us got big heads or anything like that. We just, you know, kind of like, okay, hey, you know, we're working actors and we're glad to be working. So, you know, really after the show and the continuation of it is really when I've become more and more aware of what the show means to the audience, to the fans, the people who've watched it for all these years, you know, and the fact that it's still on and still so popular, you know, nearly 50 years after we did The Homecoming.
Yeah. Oh, people still love that show. I still love it. I still watch it, the old episodes.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't, at the time it was on, because VCRs, recording devices, really didn't come into existence until, you know, in the 70s. And at first they were really big and really costly. And so I don't think I didn't have a VCR until, you know, late in the show, you know, like towards almost, you know, like late 70s. And so there's episodes I've probably never seen, because if I wasn't home on a Thursday night at 8 o'clock to watch it, I didn't see it. You know, maybe I caught it in the, because they'd rerun them in the summer, so maybe I'd see it then. But, you know, if I didn't, you know, if it was an episode I had a lot to do with in, I would make a point of watching it. But if it was one I didn't have much to do with, I only had a few scenes, was barely, you know, wasn't around much for the actual filming. You know, people ask me about episodes, I'm like, I have no clue. I never saw that one. I wasn't there for any of that, so I have no idea. You know, it's like, what happened? It's like, oh, okay. So, I mean, I do have most of the episodes now on DVD. So, I catch them here and there. And I've actually been starting, I don't know if you knew this, but I started a YouTube channel during COVID.
Yes, I know about that.
Yeah, so I started putting up these, like, behind the scenes about, because, you know, it's like, oh, these are the questions people are asking. And so I started just doing these little reminiscences about different episodes and the cast and stuff. And, you know, I wasn't sure how much of it I was going to do, but people have seemed to really be enjoying it and seem to be really interested. So I went, okay, well, I guess I'll keep doing it for now.
Well, yeah, as long as people are interested, why shouldn't you? And if you enjoy doing it, you might as well do it.
Well, it's always fascinating to me what interests people, what they know, what they don't know. You know, like in one case, I was talking about the house and things about the house, and that it wasn't real, that, you know, the exterior was just a facade on the back lot of the studio, and there was no back to it, and there was hardly anything inside, and we did all the inside of the house on the soundstage, so there wasn't really
right.
Two stories and how things were, you know, laid out. And there were people who was like, oh, I wish I'd never heard that. Now, you know, I wanted to imagine it was a real house. I'm like, oh, sorry. You know?
Oh, come on. I'm saying, oh, come on, to those people.
Alert.
Like,
But most of people are like, oh, that's really fascinating. I really, you know, I really like that. I like knowing that. So, you know, so hopefully most of the people are enjoying that.
Yeah, I've seen a few of them and comments and everything. I think people are really enjoying it. I mean, all the nice comments that I've seen, they have to be enjoying it.
Yeah, it's sweet, and, you know, and people have been very, very nice and very, you know, and even the questions are, you know, for the most part, really, really nice. And, you know, there's some things I will talk about and some things I won't, you know. There's just,
right.
You know, as I said to one person, it's like some, you know, yes, there's more I could say, but some of these stories aren't mine to tell, you know. And
right.
So we've all always been very protective of the show, of each other, and, you know, we share a lot with our fans. We have great fans. But, you know, what I'm willing to share about my personal life, you know, I know where my boundaries are about what I'll share and what I won't. And, you know, and I feel,
right.
you know, it's not up to me with somebody else to share anything they haven't made public, you know.
Right.
So,
right.
you know, and even some of the things that, that went on, you know, and plus it's kind of like, you know, it's a little like the house, but an extension of that. There is a magic to the show, and we know that now. I've grown to appreciate that. You know, I didn't always make friends with it, but now I have. You know, I'm embracing it much more than I did, you know, maybe in the 80s or so, you know, or whatever. And really grown to really appreciate not just that I loved the work and the people, but and I always thought there were great directors and great writers, and it was a beautiful show. You know, it was more the sort of as an actor that, you know, you want challenges. You know, at least I do, and a lot of other actors, you know, do. There's an enjoyment to doing a variety of things, and so I mean, if the show had continued and I continued to do the role, it would have been great, you know. But it's sort of like then. If I'm not doing that, then what else can I be doing? I, you know, I'm not going to relive the Waltons forever, you know.
Right.
So, you know, in finding where do I go from here, you know, when the show ended, you know, there were times in there where I got tired of hearing, oh, yeah, we know her. She's great. But, you know, she's so typecast that, you know, from the Waltons that we can't hire her, you know. It's like now we're doing this kind of show and that doesn't work. So that's why I started doing theater again. And, you know, and I think when I started moving also into writing and directing and the singing, the concert work and stuff, it was like, okay, you know, I have enough variety of creative outlets that, you know, it was like, all right, I'm happy. You know, I'm fine. This is good.
A friend of mine had asked if he could call in, and that was why I had asked you if you cared about call-ins, which he can't anyway. His name is Dan Loria, not the actor that was on the Wonder Years. He's a wrestler. he's a wrestler, and he runs his own wrestling school. And so the thing is, though, the question that he wanted me to ask you, you actually talked about it yourself, how you all got along on the set and things like that. So you already went over that. But he did want me to tell you, so I'm telling her, Dan, that he really loved you on the show. He thought you were beautiful. And he, because he was around the same age, I think you were maybe a couple years older, so you were like the older woman, and he just thinks you're a phenomenal actress. He really, really loves you. So I'm telling you that. There you go.
Thank you, Dan.
I'll make sure he listens. Now, I'm going to fast. I'm going to fast forward and start with some of the really newer stuff. And then if we have time, I'll go back to some of the older stuff. But I wanted to make sure that we got to this inclusion criteria, which it became Nowhere to Hide. And you were the producer, writer, and actress. So I want you to tell us all about that, because that movie sounds exciting, and I really can't wait to see it.
Cool. Well, thank you. Yeah, that was kind of a bit of a passion project. It's tough to kind of cover without too much in terms of, you know, spoilers, but I had read about someone, you know, somehow I'd come across something that was talking about during the war, like World War II, and then subsequently about experiments being done on soldiers, like about mind control and pills, you know, and drugs being used to, whether it was brainwash or control or, you know, whatever. And I don't remember even what it was, but it stuck with me. And I thought, this is like, if this is even partially true, this is horrifying. And that stuck with me. And so it became the basis for this film, you know, of this woman that I played, Tara, who think weird things start happening around her, and she doesn't know if she's literally going crazy or if someone is stalking her or intentionally, you know, playing mind games on her. So that was kind of the premise. And someone I knew at the time, a director, had said, okay, well, if you write that, you know, we'll do it. And so he co-produced it with me. And it's very different from the Waltons. So, you know, it's not family friendly. but if you like mind games or, you know, kind of psychological dramas, this is really kind of in there. It's, you know, it's kind of a slow burn to kind of find out what's going on and who's behind it and that sort of thing. So it was like a small indie film that everybody involved really, you know, gave their time and energies, and we knocked it off really fast. But it was just something I really wanted to get made to potentially, you know, maybe raise the question and have people go, ooh, you know, maybe when someone says, hey, take this, you know, that maybe they'll go, wait a minute, let me do a little checking into that. What exactly are some of these? I'm not a big fan of big pharma, you know. I feel like there's a lot of over-medication going on in circumstances where it really isn't needed and isn't helping. And when I hear stories of infants being medicated for, you know, depression, I'm like, are you kidding me? I mean, it just infuriates me as a parent, as I feel like anybody, we have a duty to protect children, you know, and it's one thing as an adult where you have an opportunity to make an informed decision. And if you choose not to inform yourself before you make a decision, fine. But with children, so much of the time they become victims of things that they have no say in, or parents that are forced to medicate their child, or they won't be allowed to put them in school, or, you know, so things like that. I just feel that there's something going on with all of that that just doesn't sit well with me. And I don't claim to be an expert on any of it. I feel like we need to understand more, and that there might be alternate choices that people and parents can know about and be given as choices to be able to better care for their children. So that was, you know, I kind of wanted the conversation to be happening. So, and hopefully along the way, we made a film that some people enjoy. You know, unfortunately, we ran into some issues with, you know, it's always, if you have time issues, it's because you have budget issues. It's like, you know, time and budget, you know, which go hand in hand. So there were some things relative to the way it wraps up in the ending that I'm not happy with. I think it's too confusing to people. And some of that was, you know, the director didn't fully understand. He thought he did, but he didn't. And so the way it was shot didn't really make sense. And then when it was being edited, there wasn't really a way to fix it. And so I'm a little disappointed in that aspect of it, because people quite often go, well, I don't know, what does that mean? You know, right at the end, what does that mean? I'm like, oh, shoot. So, you know, I'd always hoped that maybe we could do a sequel, but, you know, that opportunity has not come along and may not really be necessary. But, you know, a lot of people have seen it and really enjoyed it and found it thought-provoking. So if people want to see it, it's, you know, it's available on a number of streaming platforms. And, you know, and even these days, I kept telling people, look, you can see it for free. You know, it's on Tubi TV, which is a free streaming platform. So you can see it for free on a free streaming platform. You know, I think it's on Amazon. But it's like, because it changed names, it's also a little confusing. On Tubi, it's on under Nowhere to Hide. On, I think, Epinox, it's also on under Nowhere to Hide. On Amazon, it's under inclusion criteria, but it's the same film. We, at one point, the distributors wanted us to change the title for something or other, change the artwork, change the title. So then it got a little confused. So if you watch either one, it's the same film. It's just under a different name, but nothing else is different.
Right. Yeah, that's always confusing when they do that, when they change the names of films like that.
Yeah, sometimes they do, like when it's going into foreign distribution or, you know, different things, and it's like, okay, you know, because I had someone go, oh, I want to see Nowhere to Hide. And I'm like, okay, here are your options. They're like, oh, inclusion criteria. Oh, I saw that. So it's the same film. I'm like, yep. Okay, good. I'm glad you found that out before you bought it again. You know, also if people want the DVD, they can order that through me, through my website. Also, it's available on Amazon to buy as well. I can't remember under which title, but if you order it through my website, I sign them all personally. Anything you order through my website, I personally sign. So just an FYI for people.
Yeah, that's very,
that's true
very
with
cool.
my CDs
and of course,
too. Yeah.
And of course, that's judynorton.com.
It is, yeah. Hopefully easy to find.
Now, I wanted to fast forward a little bit again and go to this because mm-hmm. I like the title, especially since it's apropos for these times. It's a little series called The Quarantine Bunch. And
yeah.
you have acted in all six of the episodes so far. So tell us about that show.
A writer friend of mine, I'm in a writer's group. And through this writer's group, I had met this very talented writer, Ryan James, and had seen a number of his, you know, plays and things. And so when the quarantine started, he had this concept, and, you know, which was sort of a group of former child actors, you know, former child stars who had like a support group. And, you know, that was the concept. And they would normally, in theory, meet in person, but because of the shutdown, they were meeting on Zoom. So he wrote these six episodes of our supposed, you know, characters, and they are parodies of us and exaggerated parodies and, you know, and in some cases just plain really silly. And I end up sort of kind of like the den mother, you know, trying to be the voice of reason in the midst of these five crazy guys, you know, Keith Coogan and Dylan McDermott and, I'm spacing on names, and I so apologize to the gentlemen because they're all so good. Do you have them under there under your?
it's going to take me a minute to pull it up, but go ahead and talk, and I'll look it up while you're talking.
Yeah, so we shot it all. Everybody was, like, at home, and we shot it via Zoom, and then the director took all of the footage and edited it together, and it's just it's like short segments, no more than 10 minutes each, and remarkably silly. So if you just want to, you know, sit down and have a silly little laugh during all of this craziness, then you know, the Quarantine Bunch might be right up your alley.
Okay, here it is. Keith Coogan, Melissa Disney, Dean McDermott, Jeremy Miller, and of course yourself,
right.
Danny Pintaro, Scott Schwartz, Gail Borges, Ted Lange, Will Tabaris, however it's pronounced. Some of these I'm probably murdering their names. Stephen Wishnoff.
The key, you know, the key group of the child actors are Keith Coogan, Dean McDermott, Jeremy Miller, me, and Danny Pintaro and Scott Schwartz. So that's kind of our core group, and the others, and Ted Lange makes, you know, from Love Boat makes a guest appearance, and everybody else pretty much, you know, makes a little flyby guest appearance. So yeah, and it's on YouTube. So, yeah.
That's something I want to see. I'm going to have to look for it. So it is on YouTube.
It is on YouTube, yes. And
cool.
We don't take ourselves seriously at all, nor should you if you're watching it.
Okay, let's move on to Out of the Fight. Now, this is supposedly it's completed, and you were acting in that. And so I have no idea what it's about or anything because I didn't really read the synopsis. So if you just want to tell us about that one.
Yeah, it hasn't been released yet. It's just been finished and it has distribution, but it hasn't been actually released yet. It's kind of a PTSD type thing. A soldier who's been in Afghanistan, you know, and runs into it's just the stuff that's going on for him that he's experiencing, and then he tries to come back home because he's just not doing well, and they bring him back. I think he has a slight injury or something. He comes back, and he just isn't reorienting to being back home, and everything that is still sticking with him from his time there. And then he goes back. So it's really kind of dealing with that whole aspect of what our military go through, and in dealing with that, and another major issue that we address in our country or don't address effectively enough,
Right. Yeah.
So I am a therapist that he sees who is none too helpful. That's unfortunately the case in a lot of circumstances. So Steve Moon, who wrote and directed it, is someone I've known for a lot of years, and we have, I did some assisting on the script, sometimes it was just no more than input, he'd want my opinion and I'd give it to him for better or worse. So he invited me to come out and work on it when he went, hey, we're finally going to make this. And he and I have teamed up on another script project that we're hoping to, when we're at a point where it's a little easier to film safely, then, hopefully he'll be able to put that one together as well.
Mm. Well, there's this one that's, according to IMDb anyway, it's still in pre-production, and you wrote it and you're acting in it, Shoot Like a Girl. I like the title. So tell us about that one.
that one's going to be fun. We're in development. We're, looking for, the producer is looking to pull the funding together for that film. But we shot a trailer about a year ago or something like that. It's about billiards, so pool, as in, shooting pool, not shooting guns.
Mm-hmm.
He Raw Hannah, who is the producer on the project and who was the male lead in my film Nowhere to Hide. So he's also part of my writer's group. So I have a lot of these writer's group connections. So I brought him on board on my film. And then at one point he told me about this concept because he does commentary for pool tournaments, like the major for the whole pool circuit and whatnot. So he's very familiar mm-hmm. with the subject, and he works a lot with the junior teams, with the U.S. junior team. And would just talk about these players and how amazing they are and their personalities and stuff. He said, I want to do a film that really tells about and does the pool right. Because, it's like anything that you really know about. You look at it, and if it's not accurate, you go, oh, that's a joke, And so he would talk about how a lot of pool films are just, they don't get it right. The pool is just stupid. They don't, it's like, okay, I got it. So he said, I want to do something where it's accurate, where, people in the pool world will actually respect it. So it's kind of following a young girl who's, wants to go pro, wants to be a champion, and kind of what that takes, So it's kind of like a Rocky, a kind of one of those underdog kind of that you want to root for and everything she goes through to try and make it and learn about herself in the process and what it takes to, to kind of be a champion. So we're hopefully, I wrote the script on that and it's it's being shopped around, so to speak.
Mm. Sounds interesting to me. So,
well, we hope that it'll appeal because it's sort
ahead.
Of a combo where the pool will be a part of it, but it's if you're not a pool person, you don't have to be to because we're trying to make it it's more about the characters, it's about the journey, it's about their relationships and stuff. So it's it's human element of the story more than it's just not just an action film or something.
Oh, well, cool, because so it's not just about people just shooting pool all day, which, I mean, even that wouldn't be that bad if you're really into watching people play pool. But if you're watching a movie, you kind of want more than just that. Like you say, it's got to be more than just action. You want some character development.
Absolutely. Yeah, and you have to care about the characters. You have to be, any time, like, you're telling a story, you have to, your audience has to be willing to go on the journey with those characters. So they either, because they hate them and they want to see them fail, or because they like them and they want to see them succeed, or a combination of the two. You know, you got to engage. Audiences are smart. They're smarter than ever. So you really can't just give them fluff. You know, there needs to be some substance there. And then, you know, the performances need to be honest and, you know, and realistic. So that's what I'm always trying to do when, you know, whether I'm acting or I'm writing, you know, is give people something that they can in some way relate to.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, because I know when I watch these movies, it doesn't have to be action-packed, but there's got to be something there. I've got to care about the people. If I don't care about the people, I just get bored and I end up turning the thing off.
Yeah, no, I agree. There's shows where it's like I love the premise and I start it and I go, it's just something about it isn't working for me. You know, I can't get on board with it. And, you know, I mean, that's the challenge these days. There's so many options for an audience that if you can't engage people quickly, you know, you're not going to keep them. They're not even going to watch the whole thing. You can't go, yeah, but it gets really good. It's like, you know, you can't keep people's attention long enough to get to the, oh, it got really good. Oh, it ended well. You know, like, okay.
Yeah, now see, for me, I don't need a bunch of action or even a bunch of comedy or anything like that. I just need to be interested. I've watched a lot of movies that had almost no action in them, and they were really, really good movies. And then I've watched other ones that were full of action and special effects and all kinds of crap, and I watched it and went, eh. You got
to
have that character
nowhere to
development.
Nowhere to hide. Oh, really, yeah, works for you, because there's just not a lot of action. You know, we didn't have the budget for a lot of action, so it's. But I worked really hard to try and weave the story to, you know, to make it keep you guessing.
Right. Well, that's not to say that I don't like action. I like action in a film if it, you know, goes along with the storyline. But if all you, it's like what I've said with a lot of things. If all you have is action, you don't really have a good movie. If all you have is special effects, you don't really have a good movie. If all you have is naked women, you don't really have a good movie. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's my thinking on it.
Yeah. I mean, I can really thoroughly enjoy, you know, things like Star Wars and the Marvel, you know, things. But I think they make them fun as well. You know, it's action and fun. You know, I think both those franchises have overall done a really good job with them. So I can enjoy a good action packed, you know, white hats and black hats kind of a, you know, modern day.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Western.
Yeah,
so I mean, I have, you know, there's a lot of type of stuff, you know. Yeah. So I get a little tired today of all of the stuff that's just really dark and dysfunctional. You know, like, you know, particularly right now where life doesn't have all the elements that we're used to. So. You know, sometimes, but that, you know, that's just personal preference, and I totally respect, you know, everybody's got different tastes, so I don't expect everybody, and I'm older, so, you know, that's, you know, I don't necessarily enjoy the same things my son does, you know, so it's kind of, we each have, and my dad, you know, for years, he's like, they don't make movies like they used to, they don't do TV like they used to, I'm like, okay, Dad, I got it, you know, so I'm like, oh, shoot, I'm going to sound like my dad. I don't ever want that to happen. I think there just should be something for everyone. You know, if you don't like what's on, you know, some of the stuff that's on, keep digging, you know, because there is some, you know, there is still some lovely stuff being made. You just have to find it.
Oh, yeah, because not everybody likes the same thing. I'm a semi-professional movie reviewer, and I get contracted sometimes to write my reviews. And when I don't really care for the movie, I don't get brutal and say this is a piece of crap, because I know that it takes a lot of work to make a film. And just because I don't like it doesn't mean somebody else isn't going to like it. And I can point out all the good things in a film. Even if I don't like the film, I can point out a lot of good things about it, like if it's got good cinematography, good music, good editing, good acting. I can point all those things out without actually coming out saying, I didn't like this movie. So
that's the way I like to write
my reviews.
Yeah. Because, and I like, because sometimes, you know, like I'll read reviews and it'll say, well, if you like this kind of film, it's probably up your alley. If you don't, then this may not be your cup of tea. And it's like, good, that's helpful, because then I know I can read it and go, all right, well, I don't like that type of film, so it probably wouldn't be for me. But, you know, oh, I do like that. I get that the reviewer doesn't like that kind of film, but I do. So, you know, great. That's helpful.
Right. Right. Like with me, I don't care that much for war movies. I mean, there's exceptions, but I don't care that much for war movies as a general rule. And a very good actor, producer, director friend of mine, he had made a war movie and he wanted me to review it. And I go by a 0 to 5-star system. And I told him that I gave it 3.5, and he was actually ecstatic. And I explained it to him. I said, let me explain it to you, though. See, I don't care for war movies. So somebody who likes war movies watching this movie might give it 5 stars. I really only gave it 3.5 because I really don't care that much for war movies to begin with. But the acting and the action and the special effects were all great. Everything was really, really good in it. I just don't like war movies. But he was ecstatic with the 3.5, so there you go. I do want to move on. Sorry about taking up time on your show.
Oh, no, it's totally fine, you know. Edit as you feel inclined.
Now, there's one called Pretend Love, and it says that was announced, so I don't know if it's gone any farther or not.
Yeah, nothing's happening with that, you know. It's indefinitely on the shelf currently.
Because of COVID.
No, just, you know, it was a new producer that, and he just, you know, wasn't able to, you know, get it happening in the way that he had hoped, you know, so it's like, okay, fair enough.
Okay.
So I'm not doing anything with the script right now. It's kind of it's a sweet little romantic comedy, but, you know, I don't have a place for it at the moment. So maybe at some point, you know, so that's the thing, like anytime I write scripts, just, you know, they can always be retooled for a certain direction, or somebody goes, hey, I really want a blah, blah. So it's handy to have different things that you can go, oh, you're looking, I've got something, you know, here, you can read this. Is this what you're looking for? You know, that type of thing.
Yeah, you never know. It might be, like you say, reworked into something else. Well, then let's move on to another one. It's supposed to be in post-production, according to IMDb. Motivation, you acted in that one. Tell us about that one.
Yeah,
I did read what that one was about.
It's a sweet story. I didn't have much to do in it. It was kind of one of those things that I did a little cameo as a favor for the people who were doing it, who were lovely people. And but it's, you know, it's a sweet story of a guy who, you know, hasn't really, can't get it together, but, you know, decides he's going to be a motivational speaker, but he really can't get it together, and sort of how he kind of finds his way. You know, his brother is like the golden child, and, you know, and everything he does is he messes up with, and so him kind of finding his place and where he fits in, and how you don't have to try and be somebody else. You know, you just have to find a way to be your, cliche, your best self, you know, and have confidence in yourself. And so it's just, yeah, his little journey.
Oh, it sounds like a something that would be worthwhile watching.
Yeah, hopefully they'll, you know, I mean, I think COVID has slowed a lot of things down in terms of getting things finished and getting them out there and whatnot. So hopefully, you know, we'll hear more about that. I think people, you know, also may be hesitating to release things right now, you know, because the avenues are tough. And if you want to try and go the festival route, that's not as available. And you know.
Right. Yeah. So. Yeah. I mean, it does make things really, really difficult. There's a short that you wrote called Neighbors. Tell us about that one.
You know, it was just something I wrote for a producer I've worked with, and you know, it was a concept he had. So, you know, not a whole lot I can tell you about. It was something he was doing for one of those like 48-hour film festival, you know, short film festival type things.
Okay.
Yeah. So
gotcha.
Beyond, you know, helping retool the script. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we can go on to another one, you know, going backwards in time now because I covered all the newer stuff. Another Day in Paradise. You wrote that one and you acted in that one as well. Tell us about that one.
Yeah. Well, that one is another one I'm still waiting for it to be released. There's two films that I did for this producer, both of which I wrote and acted in, that for new producers. So he has been, you know, working his way through stuff and has yet to actually get these films released, which is, you know, a touch frustrating as the, you know, I'd like to have them out there so people can see them, but they, you know, I've seen screenings of them. So they're getting there. Another Day in Paradise it's kind of one of the, if you go back to the old sort of summer movies, it's really just light teenage fun, you know, a family who owns a water park. We shot the whole thing at a water park in Arizona. Great sort of old school water park. It doesn't have all the big fancy slides, but it's got literally a surf pool. You know, you can learn to surf at this place. They can put up, you know, put on the surf waves and, you know. And so it's, you know, this family that the father and these two and his twin daughters, you know, they lost their mother a year ago and they're still struggling to find their way. And so the girls are lifeguarding for the summer and, you know, getting into trouble. And the father's just, you know, kind of a little checked out because he just hasn't got it together yet. And they're worried about him, that, you know, trying to get him back on track. What's going to happen? I play his sister who's concerned about what's going on and that the girls are getting into trouble because he's not really paying attention. And, you know, so the family having to, you know, figure out how to find their way back from the loss of their mother.
Yeah. It's mainly a comedy?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of comedy, you know, drama with comedy, you know, one of those in that comedy, drama, comedy kind of, you know, range. And, you know, stars Frankie Muniz, who's always funny. He was fun to write for and to work with. And Ryan Ochoa, who was in King of Hearts or Ace of Kings, one of the, you know, sort of Nickelodeon shows. Angie Everhart. All the lifeguards and the kids around the pool and the, you know, I always remembered those like sort of summer movies that all this sort of Gidget and, you know, Moondog, whatever the name was. And, you know, that were just, they were light and they were fluffy and they were fun and they were summer movies, you know, they weren't meant to be anything other than just a kind of a fun go and enjoy it and don't take it too seriously kind of thing. And that's what this sort of is. You know, if you're looking for great, deep, hidden moments, not so much. I mean, there's some moments, you know, some things happen. There are some stakes, some things at stake, but, you know, mostly just designed to be fun.
Yeah, I like those kind of movies too, so I'll probably enjoy that.
Cool.
There's another one because we got something like 10 minutes left of the hour and a half that I scheduled.
Okay.
Because I didn't know how long we were going to be going, but we might as well go ahead and talk about some more of these, or rather you talk about them. Finding Harmony.
The other one.
Wrote that
Finding
one.
Harmony.
Yeah.
That was the first film that I wrote that was produced, and that one, you know, was kind of, it's sort of a modern day. The producer and I, we were kind of like, oh, I want to do a Western. I said, but, you know, dealing with a period Western is tough. Let's do it like a modern day. So it's like, you know, I'm a horse person. I ride horses. I jump horses. I'm like, I love being able to work around horses, and not that I got to, but anyway. So I ended up writing this, this story. It's three generations, like in the music industry, you know, the father, the patriarch of the family, record producer who was so busy with his clients. His daughter felt like he never had time for her. So, you know, she then married one of his clients who's a big, you know, big country Western star played by Billy Zane. And Allison Eastwood is the daughter. And so she turned away from all of it, you know, major chip on her shoulder. They have a daughter together who now at 16 wants to be a singer-songwriter. So now she's got the conflict of, you know, not wanting her daughter to go down this road that she feels lost to her marriage, and she feels, you know, broke up her family, and, you know, so the three generations and the music and trying to, you know, again, work through that. And the father, the ranch, this was the thing, one of the things elements I really loved in there was that he uses the ranch for troubled boys. Like he runs a program for boys who've kind of fallen between the cracks in the system and stuff like that and have gotten in trouble. So he brings them onto the ranch and, you know, has kind of a work program for them to sort of, you know, help them get their lives together and stuff. So what was fascinating about this was we ended up shooting it in Alabama, in Florence, Muscle Shoals area of Alabama. And the ranch that they ended up finding to use is a ranch called Fame Ranch. It was owned by the man who owned Fame Records and the recording studio. So, and they, when the family, when at some point the family donated or sold the property to be used for young women, young girls, teenage girls who were in trouble. So it's like the synchronicity of this was like, oh my goodness, everybody thought that the script was written because of the location. And yet the script was written long before they found this location, but it just was like meant to be, you know. And the scenery is just stunning. You know, the cinematography, you want to review some, you know, some gorgeous cinematography. I mean, this thing is like, you know, Tim Burton, cinematographer, just, you know, did a phenomenal job. I think it's just gorgeous. And, you know, and wonderful cast, you know, Allison Eastwood, Billy Zane, Ed Bruce, William Shockley, Barry Corbin, you know, I mean, it's just a beautiful cast of actors, and, you know, this one's a family story. This is very much like when it gets released, hopefully, you know, before too long, then I think this is one that my Walton followers will really appreciate. And a country, and a score, and music. Billy Zane sings. Who knew Billy Zane was like a country singer, you know? There you go.
I've actually heard him singing in a couple of things, so it's not a surprise to me, but that's nice that he's going to sing in that.
Yeah, he's terrific in it. He's, you know, I've heard people say they think it's some of his best work. You know, he's won, you know, at some film festivals it was in, he won Best Actor, and, you know, I mean, just, just, yeah, really beautiful performance.
Well, good. I'm glad that that everything is so far working okay, except for the COVID thing.
Yeah, right.
And I hope it gets released. I mean, because
yeah.
I want to see it.
Yeah. I'd love it to be out there so that, you know, people can enjoy it, appreciate it, you know. Probably the other one that people can check out that is out there and available is a series I worked on as both an actor and as a writer and director called Bluff. And it's kind of what we call sort of a cop soap. I shot it up in Canada.
I was
going to
bring that one up.
Yeah. And I play
okay,
a judge.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I play a judge, and it's a mythical town called Decina. And, you know, it's the combo, you know, their police force. And we shot the whole thing up in Calgary, Alberta. And, it's unique because it's six half-hour episodes, you know, which never gets done. But follows these detectives and what goes on in their little town with, you know, the sort of mob bosses and, you know, so your typical kind of, and they're dealing with human trafficking and, you know, your usual assortment of nasty characters. So that one, it's available. I think it was on Amazon. I believe, I'm trying to remember where else it is. Because I know it was on Amazon, I think it's still available to stream on Amazon.
Are you still there, Judy?
Yeah.
Okay, so
hello?
I just wanted to make sure it got a little quiet there.
Yeah, no, I was just trying to figure out if, where, because it's been a while since I checked on it. So it's like, hopefully
well,
I'm not crazy.
Yeah,
yeah it
yeah,
is. Well, the DVD's available
in
season one. Yeah, I know. I just, things move on different, you know, on streaming platforms and stuff.
Well, we're down to the last, like, 2.5 minutes. So you already talked about your judynorton.com, and I'll just remind people that they can go to judynorton.com, and they can buy a DVD and get it autographed. They can buy your CD. And can't they mm-hmm. also find out about upcoming things on there?
Yeah, I need to update because it's a new website and I need to update some things. We mentioned the YouTube channel. It's Judy Norton channel if you want to see, you know, some of the behind the scenes that I'm doing about the Waltons and answering questions and whatnot. They can go to YouTube and see me talking about the Waltons and so come join.
Okay. Well, what I usually do at this time, because we're down to like a minute and a half, is I ask my guests to let the listeners know what is the best way to contact them.
Oh, gosh. I'm on social media. On Facebook, you just have to find I have a personal page, but I never look at it, and I basically don't. It's just kind of for family. There is a fan page where if you find the little icon of Mary Ellen, it's my Walton one, and I do interact with that one. I'm on Twitter, same thing. Look for, you know, you just have to recognize my face. I think on Twitter, I'm the Judy Norton. On Instagram, I'm on official Judy Norton. So you can find me on, you know, on social media, and then you can subscribe to my website as well. And I don't know that there's a way to send me messages through my website, but, you know, on the other social media, obviously you can put comments down and whatnot. And I try to read as much as I can, as time allows.
Well, yeah, there's only so much you can do. Okay, so it's actually I'm looking at your website right now, and there is a little thing to click that says contact.
Ah, there we go. Okay.
So there you go. Okay, Judy Norton, it has been a pleasure, a really big pleasure having you on the show. And maybe sometime in the future you would like to come back. I know I would love that. But I thank you. I want you to have a good afternoon, evening, whatever. And please stay safe.
Okay, great. You too. Thanks. And you'll have to let me know if you get a chance to see Nowhere to Hide.
I will. I'll let you know.
Okay
thanks again.
Awesome.
And
okay,
I'm going to close
you.
Out the show. Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.